Tess Gerritsen is my guest. If you listen very carefully, we're about to begin taking questions for Dr. Gerritsen. So if you've got a sort of weird medical question, you know, in the very weird category, like death and the kinds of things we've been talking about, here come the numbers.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
To think that it might be in the end the little things that get us. I know, don't let the little things bother you, right? You never let them bother you. Well, these little things bother you. Dr. Tess Gerritsen is my guest. She'll be right back. Of course, sometime before the beginning of the year, I think I told you all that bird flu was my absolute biggest fear, and the fact that I saw these scientists continually pummeling us with stories that it was, you know, virtually saying it's going to happen, that you could almost presume it will happen. And if it did happen, if the viruses got together, exchanged RNA, married, became the worst scenario, what are we looking at?
Well, I can take as our model the 1918 pandemic, otherwise known as the Spanish flu. Now, of course, the number of deaths probably wouldn't be so bad because I would assume that some of those were due to bacterial pneumonia, which we can treat. But just looking at the Spanish flu, it killed 50 million people around the world. It killed about 700,000 just in the United States alone.
Now, of course, that was then.
That was a third of our current population.
I know, but I mean medically, that was then, and this is now. Wouldn't science save us?
Well, not necessarily, and you know why? Because a certain number of those deaths were directly from the virus itself. It was a particularly bad death, and sometimes they would die within 12 hours of their first symptoms. So you may not even get a chance to get into a doctor.
Boy, that's fast.
It's very fast. And what was really frightening was that it was killing young people.
Why is it that fast? And especially with young people.
With young people, part of it was that part of the reason for the deaths was because the body was responding. It was actually our immune system that was killing us. You know, that what happens when you get an influx of this virus is that your immune system pours out white blood cells and various toxins to try and kill the virus. And what it ends up doing is flooding your air spaces in your lungs so that you get pneumonia.
Oh.
You just can't breathe. There's no way to exchange oxygen with your bloodstream.
Well, we do, though, have more control over pneumonia these days, don't we?
Yeah, well, that's for bacterial pneumonia. You can give antibiotics. But these young people were dying of viral pneumonia. They were dying of their bodies trying to overwhelm this virus and instead overwhelming their lungs. So they were, you know, their epithelium, their the surfaces, the mucous membranes of their lungs were wearing away, and so people were coughing up blood. They were bleeding from all their orifices, and they would die very quickly. And what made it worse, of course, and this is another thing that is different, is that what was happening in 1918, well, we were at war, and there were huge numbers of young men who were collected into these recruitment camps.
Right.
And so they were all, you know, living under the same tents, and it may have been, it was very cold that winter, so they were all huddled together. And that's part of the reason it was spreading so quickly. But a lot of the spread just was within the military encampments. But then they would leave, and it would spread into the regular population. And I was looking at some statistics that just terrified me. You know, in Philadelphia, 43% of the medical staff at one hospital had to be hospitalized themselves, and a fifth of the nurses died.
Wow.
You're looking at Cook County, where the mortality rate for influenza was 40%.
Wow.
And half of the people were getting it. So in large cities in particular, it was very dangerous because you were exposed to other people. The only place that didn't get it was, I saw there was a little town in Nevada that actually barricaded itself. It wouldn't let anybody in town.
That is our mentality.
Yeah, well, nobody died in that town, so it worked.
It did work, huh?
It worked.
And if something like this got loose, Doctor, what would you personally do?
I personally?
Yes.
I hate to make a run on Tamiflu, but frankly, I don't think our country has got enough stockpiled. I would probably just try and stay indoors. I would stay away from other people. I would barricade my house, and I would try and keep my kids in one spot and tell them not to go out.
How effective is Tamiflu?
Excuse me?
How effective is Tamiflu against...
Well, all I can tell you is that people who work with viruses, if they're accidentally exposed, that's what they take.
Well, again, though, is there a way to know, do they have any statistics on how effective it apparently is or isn't?
Well, we're not entirely sure about bird flu because, you know, it does appear to be effective, though, in bird flu. And the way Tamiflu works is it affects one of the proteins on the virus, which it actually prevents the virus from being spread once it's invaded your cells, so it kind of keeps it from multiplying very quickly, and it works for other viruses as well, but it does seem to be the one thing that is the most effective. Unfortunately, it's pretty expensive, and as I said, this country just does not have enough. Now, the other thing, of course, is a vaccine. The problem with developing a vaccine is you're working with a moving target. By the time you figure out what the final flu virus is going to look like, it's going to take you 6 months to manufacture the vaccine. And by that time, you may have had, you know, already one wave of an epidemic.
Right. Whew. So it could go. The other side of the coin is we have the ability to travel the entire world very quickly now. Airplanes going from continent to continent. And if something like that did get loose fairly widely,
it'd be fast. It would be very, very fast.
It would certainly encompass the world quickly, wouldn't it?
Yes, in one day, right around the world. And that, you know, that's the other thing that we have to worry about. Even though we have these antibiotics for bacterial infections, everything moves much faster now. So it could move much faster. I know that the UN has really has devoted quite a lot of attention to just watching for outbreaks in Southeast Asia, which is where we think it will happen. But we have to remember that the Spanish flu, the outbreak started in Kansas. So that was a domestic case of
you see, I didn't know that. It started in Kansas. Then why didn't they call it the Kansas flu?
Okay, well, here is another part of the story that made 1918 a very strange era. Because we were at war, there was censorship. And you know, this is a lesson we should learn always, is that the government told the media that you are not to say anything bad about the war. You are not to print anything that will affect the morale of the American public.
Uh-huh.
So that we were not told about these huge numbers of soldiers who were dying. Britain was at war. They were under the same kind of restrictions on their press. The only country that was still neutral that was able to talk about it was a newspaper in Spain. So it was first reported in the Spanish newspapers, even though it had not started in Spain, and so it got the nickname the Spanish flu.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, but it started in Kansas, and we're not really sure why. It may have been, Kansas has a lot of pig farms, I assume. It could have been incubating there.
Well, boy, did I just learn something, or what?
Amazing. don't keep information from the public. It's a very important thing.
Well, China seems to be the chief incubator these days.
Well, that's because they have a lot of contact between people and poultry, and they live with their ducks and their chickens.
Harkening back to an earlier subject, Mark in New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, says, "Hey, Art, would you please ask the doctor, is there a double-sided zipper inside a body bag so if you wake up in one, you can get out?" It's a pretty good question, actually.
I don't believe so. I haven't really checked. I don't think there is a double-sided zipper, so I'm afraid you're stuck in there. But most cases of people who were found alive, they made noise, and somebody luckily heard them.
Now, that story you told me about the fellow, the doctor, about to cut into the body on the table and the hand grabbing him and his dying, that's really a true story?
That's a true story. It's a true story. I have, you know, there's another story like that. There was a, I think he was a cardinal in the 1500s who had died, and it was going to be a postmortem on him, and they cut open his chest, and they looked, and the heart was still beating.
Oh, God.
And he died, of course.
Oops. Oh, my goodness. All right. A million people want to talk to you. So, first-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. I have actually a question for the doctor. I just finished reading Michael Crichton's Prey, the one you suggested to read a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, sir.
Very good book. I was just wondering what the doctor's opinion about nanite technology and...
All right. Let me help out here. Prey was a really good book, as I mentioned to you, I think, just before the show. It was about these nanites, these designer little machines that are sort of set loose in a swarm with the idea of making a camera that nobody could shoot down for the Defense Department. And... this is technology that we're on the edge of and we are working with right now, Doctor.
I wish I could comment, but I didn't read the book.
Right, but the technology itself, nanotechnology, is something you can comment on if you know anything at all about it. It's kind of, I don't know, the molecular genes side of the, you know, of what's being done in medicine.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it to say anything about it. So
working down, well, maybe you can answer this then. I know you wrote Gravity, and you studied the space program pretty extensively in order to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have astronauts had sex yet in space?
Art, you asked me this question last time, and then, you know what? They're not going to tell me. They're not going to tell me.
Well, I thought I'd try one more time, and perhaps you've forgotten that you didn't answer it then and would now. I ask everybody this question. I've had astronauts on. They don't answer either, by the way.
Well, you know, I actually asked that question while I was at Houston. They wouldn't tell me.
Well, the fact that they wouldn't tell you might be an answer.
I suppose so.
Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Gerritsen. Hi.
Hello. I think that God and evolution are not incompatible. And so my version of the Asimov quote, which you mentioned at the bottom of the last hour, which was that any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from magic, my version is any sufficiently advanced deity can act in ways that may be indistinguishable from science.
To science.
That's a wonderful way of saying it. You know, I agree with you. I don't think they're incompatible. There are some people who say maybe if there was a God, he set in motion evolution.
Yeah, and I think that John Muir, about 100-something years ago, came up with a concept of that there was not a creation, and then it stopped, and then the world, now we're living in what's created, but that it's a continual process of creation. And I think possibly he was not the first to come up with that, but as far as I know, he was. And so if you look at it from that point of view, a lot of things, like, for instance, things you refer to as mistakes, obviously if something bad happens to me or you, we refer to that was a mistake or someone did something.
No. She was talking about things like the appendix.
Right, exactly. Well, I was going to use your what you spoke about, the appendix was actually very brilliant in a way, because if you look at that, the appendix as an analogy, from a lot of old-fashioned viewpoints, they viewed Antarctica or the Arctic as wastelands. They were sort of useless, or volcanoes and earthquakes were just useless and terrifying things that served no purpose. And now we can see that Antarctica regulates our climate. Now we can see that volcanoes actually created our climate. We wouldn't breathe if it weren't for volcanoes.
And so why in God's name are we ruthlessly ripping the appendixes out?
Exactly, exactly. Because in the future, 500 years from now, we may not view these things as unvaluable. We may view them as valuable.
All right. Doctor?
Well, we're ripping them out because they're killing us. No, the appendix probably did have a function at some time, and maybe it has a function that we're not aware of. There's always that possibility. But at this moment, it does not appear to do anything that is vital to our survival.
I think I'll start the rumor that it's the antenna that sends a prayer to God.
And then and the other question is, what are we doing with our wisdom teeth, for instance? And what do snakes have vestigial pelvises for? We're not really sure, but it does seem to imply that these things must have had a function.
Well, all right, tell me about wisdom teeth, if you wouldn't mind. Yes, what about them? Why do we have them taken out, and what happens if we don't?
If you don't, they cause you a lot of pain, and they cause a lot of crowding. And the question, is why do we have them? It appears that we must have had larger jaws at some time, in our ancestry. And as somebody who had all four of mine taken out, and everybody in my family has had all four of their wisdom teeth taken out, I can testify that they are a pain. So I don't really know why we still have them. I think it's because the human jaw has changed.
Uh-huh. What about the word? Why are they called wisdom teeth? And why must they be ripped out if they impart wisdom?
I believe they're called wisdom teeth because they came in at the age of about 18, adulthood, when you supposedly were smart.
I've learned the origin of perhaps six new words today. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Hi.
Hi. I had a couple of things. One related to what you were just talking about with the last caller on the vestigial organ situation and the junk gene stuff.
Yes.
Recently they've been talking about plants repairing their DNA when there's been a problem in the environment. And perhaps we're holding on to DNA that we had use for in case that cycle comes around again, and we need those to be able to adapt to that situation.
Yeah, plants are one of the only species that can actually, as far as I know, can do that. We have never demonstrated that capability.
We've never observed that.
We've never observed that capability.
That doesn't mean we can't do it.
What is the junk DNA for? Lord knows. I mean, I wish we knew. I tend to think that it's leftover genetic material that we just, again, it's like vestigial organs, it's vestigial DNA.
Or maybe it's for something that hasn't come up yet.
And we're
being prepared. And also, I had a body bag story for you if you wanted one.
Yes, please.
I worked for 20 odd years or so with a guy who was a LERP team radio man in Nam. And as you may or may not know, LERP teams would get dropped 50, 100 clicks up the trail to watch what was coming down to give some warning.
Yes.
And they asked him to go out one more time. He was getting very short, was due to come home in less than a week. But they said, we really got just a two-day mission. Come, go ahead for it. And they got the information they needed, and they headed for the LZ, and were letting the chopper know that they were on the way. And the guy in front of him stepped on a bouncing bedding.
Mm-hmm.
And dodged it, which of course is almost unheard of. But with the radio on him, he couldn't dodge it. He was right behind the guy, and it just shredded him. And the guys just picked him up and started running. And they said, they got the handset on the radio, and they're saying, to the chopper, get in quick because everybody in the neighborhood's going to have heard that, and they're going to be looking for us.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we're at the LZ. It's already too hot. Get to the backup. They said, we can't get there. We're carrying this guy. And they said, you got to get to the backup because we can't get in here. And so they got to the backup LZ, and it was some clicks away, so it took them a lot of time to get there. The corpsman jumped out before the chopper even hit the ground. put his fingers on his throat, put his fingers on his wrist, said he's dead, grabbed his tag, and realized he was looking down the barrels of 7 M16s, and they were saying, he's going, he's not staying. They said, we're overloaded already, you're going to kill us. They said, then you can stay. And they put him on the chopper, and of course, the corpsman came with him. But during the entire 45 minutes or an hour of flight, they never found one sign of life. They got him to the MASH unit, triage doc looked at him and said, dead.
Uh-huh.
And again, looking at 7 barrels of M16s, they said, doc, we're not expecting miracles.
About 30 seconds.
Okay, we're not expecting miracles, but you got to do what you can. They opened him up. They said, there's nothing we can do. They put a toe tag, body bag, sent him to the morgue. So he's now at about an hour and a half, 2 hours, maybe three already, since there's been any sign of life. 3 hours later, he woke up in the body bag, and they took him back, took out about 15 or 20 feet of intestine, and he lost down from 185 to about 70 pounds.
But the point is, he was alive.
Back. He came back.
Yeah.
He came back. Oh, my God.
Amazing guy.
Amazing story. Thank you very much. And Dr. Hold tough. Dr. Tess Gerritsen is my guest, and you will want to obtain every single one of her books. Set them in a pile and read them one by one. Trust me. Loves you, pretty baby. Well, we do, and we're here to help you through the night, no question about it. If you'd like to provide a little bit of input, here's how you do it.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Dr. Tess Gerritsen is my honored guest at the moment. She's a little strange. In fact, we'll ask more about that. And indeed, she is strange and likes to write about strange things. But my God, they're entertaining books. If you have a question for her, here we are. Doctor, I wonder what the title of your next book is. Has it been titled yet?
Yes, it's called Vanish.
Vanish?
Vanish. It'll be out August 23rd.
August 23rd. And it really deals with...
It's about a woman who wakes up in the morgue. And who is she? And nobody knows. You know, I wanted to comment on that last caller because there is a case out of Iraq of a similar thing, of a soldier who was shot in the head, was declared dead by a medic at the scene, was again declared dead in the helicopter, and 13 hours later, when he gets to the hospital, they detected a heartbeat, and he's now alive and able to walk. So it happens, you know, right now.
I once read a story. It was an Associated Press Wire story, as a matter of fact, and it was in the major news. Also, I think there was a man. I don't know if I mentioned this to you on the last show, but he took a gun. Well, actually, the fella had terminal cancer. He had a brain tumor, inoperable brain tumor, and he shot himself, and he lived, and he shot out the tumor.
Well, that's a hard-to-believe story. But
I couldn't believe it either, because clean as it might be, if it got the tumor, there would still be cells, messy cells around that would start it up all over again, wouldn't there?
Well, it depends what kind of tumor it is. If it's something simple as a meningioma, maybe he did manage to get it all out. Then it wouldn't necessarily regrow. So it's one of those, I have a hard time believing that, but maybe he saved himself a trip to the neurosurgeon.
Huh. All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Good morning.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
My name's Terry, and I'm calling from Atlanta. And I was born with multiple heart conditions, and I've gone to that light and come back. In 1983, they did reconstructive heart surgery, where they used to freeze your body
right.
and put you on a heart-lung machine.
Wow.
Well, what I wanted to ask Dr. Garrison, after I came through that, I started having dreams and visions of a girl that I knew, her murder. At the time, I didn't know she'd been murdered. Turns out I called her fiancé, and he told me about her murder, and it was just like my dreams and visions.
All right.
So what I call it is like a soul transference. Her soul, they lost me during the heart surgery. And when I went so far out, somehow her soul transferred.
Well, that might be a bit of a jump. I mean, it's your interpretation of what happened, but clearly you had visions and dreams and weird things are not unusual after that kind of event, are they, Doctor?
No, they're not. They're not unusual. And you say that you did not know she had been murdered
prior to
that.
That's right.
You know, is it possible that you did hear about it sometime after that, and that and that you incorporated that?
I she's not here now, but I guess it's possible. But and people do apply their own belief systems and prejudices to these sort of stories. I guess one person might see Jesus, another person might see Buddha, right?
Right, exactly. And it's hard to know what happened. It certainly is a weird story. Whether it was a soul transfer, whether she actually met somebody on the other side who told her, go back and take care of this problem I had, you know, get my murderer. I don't know where that came from, but I think that if you were going to go about this from the skeptic's point of view, you would assume that she heard about the case somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And just did not remember that she had heard about it.
Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Gerritsen. Hi.
Hi, this is Tim from L.A.
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Gerritsen, I got a question. There was a story on Coast to Coast about 2 or 3 weeks ago regarding bird flu and a possible treatment with kimchi in South Korea.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And my question is there something within the kimchi, like maybe the garlic, that actually cured the birds of the avian flu? Or do you think it's hogwash?
I have not heard about kimchi in any of the medical literature, so at this moment I'm going to say it's hogwash.
Oh, it really was a very strong story, wasn't it, caller?
Yeah, very, very, very.
Yeah, it was in the mainstream press that they absolutely believed there was something in kimchi.
Well, kimchi is, it's chili peppers and vinegar and garlic.
Right.
Well, I'm not quite sure what it would be in that combination. Garlic certainly seems to be the cure-all for a lot of things.
It does. Do you think there's anything at all to it?
Not that I can think of, no. I can't imagine why. But, it tastes good, so why not?
Which brings us to that great unknown power. If doctors really admitted it, how much... How much of a patient's cure is psychological?
A great deal. You know what? I'm looking back at the history of medicine. I'm sort of appalled by how much harm doctors have done to the patients. We didn't really know what we were doing for most of medicine. For instance, bleeding. Where did that come from? I mean, very few patients were ever cured by bleeding, and yet that heritage is still with us. There's a British medical journal called Lancet,
mm-hmm.
and that the title of Lancet derives from the old tool that they used to open up veins
to bleed people.
Yes. So no, there were a lot of things that doctors did that were probably more harm than good.
That's another one I didn't know. I'm never going to think about Lancet the same way.
Yeah. And I just think about how much, you know, all these, I read a recent history about the deaths of kings in England and what they all died from. Appalling number of them probably died from their bad doctors doing things that they shouldn't have done.
All that fine top-line medical treatment.
All the fine top, yeah, they must. And, you know, one of the worst examples of all of harm that we have done has to do with puerperal fever. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the 1800s, scores of, I mean, just how many women would die from childbirth because of infections that were given to them by doctors.
Hmm.
They're saying that in Europe, a woman had a 10 to 20% chance of dying, not from the childbirth, but from the infection that came afterwards. So, now, there are a great deal of harm was done, but I would agree with you that, you know, most things do get better with time without any medical intervention.
So that little sugar pill really does work. Actually, it works so well that you'd think in double-blind tests it would pass all the FDA requirements to cure whatever.
Placebos actually work pretty well. I think I've seen a statistic that 30% of the time placebos seem to work.
Well, then why not? Here's an idea for somebody to make $1 million. Why not actually produce, or do they? A real placebo that you could go to the pharmacy and a doctor could fill out a prescription form for, send you to the pharmacy, you get your placebo, you go home and get cured.
Because the FDA decrees that a drug must be not only safe but effective.
Well, wouldn't that fit in both categories?
I don't think that they would.
It's safe and effective.
It is safe, and it's only 30% effective, though.
Well, but 30% effective, that's a better shot than you get with some things.
For some people, there are patients I really wish I did have a placebo tablet for, because nothing else would take care of them.
Yes, sir, I'm going to patent it, the placebo pill. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Garrison.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Art?
Yes.
How you doing?
Fine.
Dr. Garrison?
Yes, hi.
Hi. I have a story about my grandfather. He's an old war veteran, and I got a call about my grandfather being in the hospital. He was a little ill.
Oh, you're going to have to speak up. Your grandfather was ill.
I'm sorry. My grandfather was ill. I got a call, and my dad told me my grandfather was ill. So we went to see him, and he seemed fine. Later that evening, we found out later that he was pronounced dead on the scene. He was then put in a body bag and brought down to the morgue. And on the way to the morgue, he just kicked back and I guess just came back.
And so they took him to the hospital.
That's right.
And you got called.
Yeah. And he came back, and you know what? He was with us for 7 years after that.
Oh, my gosh.
It was just great. We have no idea why he came back, but he just...
Came back.
You know, there's case after case after case. I have a friend who was on the way to the morgue, and the orderly accidentally hit the side of the doorway with the gurney, and he woke up. So it's rather disturbing, but sometimes the only way to know if somebody is actually dead is to put an EKG on them and see if they have any electrical activity in their heart. You may not be able to hear that heart beating very well, and you never know. If you're tired, you may put the wrong end of the stethoscope down on the chest.
Well, one thing you know for sure is that the heart of the person who makes this discovery is good.
Yes, probably.
Yes. You're on the air, Coast to Coast AM, with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Dr. Gerritsen?
Yes, hi.
And Mr. Bell?
Yes.
Okay, I have a quick comment and then a question. There was a doctor, either a doctor or scientist in France, and he was experimenting on a paraplegic, and his brain impulses would be sent to this computer box.
Yeah.
And the computer box would send messages to his lower legs, and of course his legs would supposedly move.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that on a documentary on a cable channel. But my question is, if a stealth pilot was to encircle the Earth for like 10 or 20 years beyond the speed of sound, and of course being refueled every so many thousand miles, and he was to circle the Earth for 10 or 20 years, would he age, doctor?
At the speed of light?
At the speed of sound.
Beyond the speed.
I don't think that would be measurable in terms of the aging difference.
Yeah, not the speed of sound.
But nearing the speed of light, the answer would change very much, Carl.
Yeah. Theoretically, it would change. We don't. Yeah, it would.
Okay, I was just wondering. Thank you.
All right, you're very welcome. Take care. First time caller line, your turn with Dr. Gerritsen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from Pennsylvania. I have a question for a doctor.
Okay.
Yeah, hi.
As an agnostic, I'm sorry. As a believer of God, I have, I've heard the different viewpoints of agnostics and their ideas and tried to weigh it. And I had to ask myself, you know, what if I'm wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what would be the consequences of that?
Yes.
As an agnostic, and you ask yourself that, don't you have any fear of what if you're wrong?
Okay.
I ask that question all the time, and that's why I considered myself an agnostic and not an atheist. I think I'm an open-minded person, and I'm waiting to find out. The consequences, if I'm wrong, I guess you have to believe in hell to worry about the consequences at that
stage. That's a good point.
Yeah.
You'd have to worry about a hell or... But you do have an open mind, so if there is something on the other side suddenly, and awareness and consciousness continues...
Yes, I'm willing to, you know, to be open to the possibilities. I would also think, and maybe it's only my own version of God, is that I, you know, my viewpoint of the Christianity is that God is merciful, that He is willing to welcome anybody who has been a good person, who has done works of good, and whether or not they believe, I would think that they would be welcomed. So it's a matter of what you, how you view, you know, the Almighty, whether you believe they're merciful or whether you believe they're, it's a closed, it's heaven is closed to good people.
I wonder if there's any possibility that, or what the social implications would be if science definitively answered the question of God, one way or the other. Either way would have drastic consequences. It's this not knowing that keeps us where we are.
Well, you know what? They've actually done some studies on atheists and agnostics to see what kind of social people they are. It turns out that they don't have any higher divorce rates. They don't commit any more crimes. And certainly in college students, they found that they did not cheat any more in tests. So I think that ethical behavior is not necessarily wrapped up in Christianity or in religion. It's wrapped up in your parents telling you what's right or wrong.
And not an inherent sense? Is there an inherent sense of right and wrong that goes beyond
beyond religion? I think it's something that, and it maybe it has to do also with, think about it, evolution. For us to get along with each other, for us to not be out there committing crimes and killing each other, we had to somehow develop a social sense that we are a community and that we have to do good to each other. And that it may actually be something about our survival as a species.
Mm-hmm. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Good morning.
Oh, yes, hello, Art.
Hi.
This is Keith in Hamilton, Ontario.
Yes.
I have a really weird question about useless body parts.
Okay.
If you place your hand down on a table, fingernails up, you could lift each finger upwards except for the ring finger. Why? Is that a useless finger?
I could lift up my ring
finger. So can I. I was about to just say, where are you coming from? What kind of weirdo are you, guy, that you can't lift your ring finger? Mine goes up and down just fine.
Not as high as all the other four.
Well...
I don't know. I'm having no trouble at all. It may be that you have, you know, there are some people who can roll their tongues and some people who can't. Did you know that?
Yeah.
That there's a genetic component to whether you can roll your tongue into a tube. And maybe you have one of these weird sort of genetic components where you just can't lift up your ring finger.
Yes, maybe you're the unusual one, sir.
Maybe. All right.
Or maybe your marriage is in trouble.
Oh, the ring's too heavy.
Thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Gerritsen. Hello.
About the appendix. In primitive people, they used to eat a lot of fruit, a lot more seeds. The seeds from the... Because they ate so much, fruit, that the appendix was, for some reason, I don't know if it filtered out the seeds or something. I read this.
Somebody's guess. No
yes,
doubt.
Well, it must have had some kind of a function for the digestive system, because there it is sitting at the end of the cecum, you know. Mm. But right now, we're not really sure. And then again, I did mention that there may have something to do with the immune system. We just don't know. It definitely must have had a function in an ancestor of ours.
Where do you get ideas for the books you write?
I read weird stuff. I'm one of these omnivorous people who just, I read Science Magazine. I love Science Magazine and Scientific American and Discovery and the National Enquirer. So really, Art, what I do is I read something, and if I get that punch in the gut that tells me, oh, this really bothers me, this is really scary, or this really raises the hair on the back of my neck, then I work at that to see if I can make it into a book.
How do you find life as a writer versus a doctor?
Well, I actually left medicine because I had two young kids, and I just could not do it all. I really feel sort of sorry for women who are forced to work and want to be home with their kids. I wanted to be home with my kids. So it was really them who determined this. But now that I've been a writer for I don't know how many years and making a lot more money than I ever did as a doctor, it certainly made a lot of sense.
Well, listen, as always, I want to thank you for being here. It's always, the hours just rush right by, and I hope everybody out there will rush right in and buy Gravity and then all your other books. I've read them all now.
Thank you very much, Art. It's always been fun.
And I'm looking forward to your next, which, again, is due out when?
August 23rd, Vanish.
I'll be looking for it. Take care, Doctor.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Don't forget tomorrow night, folks, the real Amityville Horror story, the real one. With George Lutz, who really was there. You want to hear something? You're going to be here tomorrow night. In the meantime, you all have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you on the next. Crystal Gale is this young lady's name.
Midnight in the desert
is the name of the song.
Shooting stars across the sky.
Night Hawk.
This magical journey take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?